Ah, yes, let the healing of the earth begin. Well, this is Michael Stone. It's Tuesday, time for Conversations. You're listening to KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City, in Truckee 105.1, translator K286 AN. Have a great show for you today. Thomas Greco, the future of money, actually the end of money and the future of civilization is what we'll be talking about today. But before I do that, I want to do the community calendar and let you know what's coming up. So Floaters and the Shreds perform 8 p.m. this Friday night at North Columbia Schoolhouse. Tickets available at Briar Patch, Mother Truckers, and online at Brown Paper Tickets and TicketWeb.com. Doors open at 7 p.m., 17894, that's 17894, Tylerfoot Road in Nevada City. Treasures in a Bag in Penn Valley is hosting a gold panning and gem hunting fundraiser Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 4 p.m. Proceeds benefit Lifetime Foundation, which promotes adoption. See treasuresinabag.com for more information. The Miners Foundry in Nevada City presents Eclipse in Concert, a Pink Floyd tribute band, on Saturday at 8 p.m. For more information, see minersfoundry.org. And this week, the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley is going to have Sergeant Funky's Hippie Dance Party at 8 p.m. on Friday. And on Saturday, Robin Ford and Renegade Creation, also at 8 p.m. For more information, go to www.thecenterforthearts.org. And Music in the Mountains presents at the Nevada County Fairgrounds Wednesday Chinese Chamber Music with Third Angle Ensemble, 7:30 p.m. and Friday Outdoor Pops with Doc Severinsen and El Remito de la Vida at 7:30 p.m. That's www.musicinthemountains.org for more information. Astro guy Wayne Watson will lead a sky show at Tobiasen Park in Nevada City near Madeline Helling Library on Friday evening. Solar viewing begins at 6:30 p.m. and dark sky viewing begins at 9 p.m. Bring a blanket and a chair. Call 470-8510 extension 205 for more information. And that's it for the community calendar today. Just a little background on the piece that I'm going to play for you today, my interview with Thomas Greco. As most of you know, our financial system, global financial system, is in quite a mess. And Thomas is someone who, for the last four decades, has been looking at creative solutions and ideas. The purpose of the show is to look at what money is and to inspire alternative possibilities and the thinking of alternative possibilities in our local communities in Sacramento and Nevada County. So I hope you enjoy listening to Thomas Greco. His book is called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Here's Thomas Greco. Welcome to Conversations. This is Michael Stone. My guest today is Thomas Greco Jr. He is a community and monetary economist, educator, writer, and consultant. He's the director of the Community Information Resource Center, which was founded in 1992. CIRC is a nonprofit consulting organization and networking hub dedicated to economic equity, social justice, and community improvement, specializing in community currency and mutual credit design, development, and implementation. He's a former engineer and professor of business administration, and Tom has written numerous books, including the recently released The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Welcome to Conversations, Tom.
Well, thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Let's start out right at the nitty-gritty here. What we're talking about money, and often we use terms that we don't really know the history or the background of, but what is money?
Well, that's an important question to start with, because few people do understand what money is or how it comes into existence. First of all, let me make clear that what I'm talking about is money as a medium of exchange. Now, the word money gets bandied around in different ways, and quite often when people use the word money, what they mean is wealth in general. But that's not what we're talking about. You know, wealth can take many forms, and money is just one form of wealth. Typically, when you say that someone has a lot of money, that doesn't mean they have a lot in their bank account. It means that they have a lot of wealth in their portfolio or in real estate, stocks and bonds and other things of that sort. But that's not what money is. Money is a medium of exchange, pure and simple. Now, money has evolved over the years and taken different forms. Now, if we look at the exchange process, specifically reciprocal exchange, where people want to get as much as they give and give as much as they get, then we've used a number of different approaches to do that, starting with primitive barter. In a barter transaction, I have something you want, you have something I want, we make a trade and everything is even. But the barter exchange is a very inconvenient situation, because we have to have a coincidence of wants and needs. If you've got something I want and I have nothing you want, then there can be no barter. Right. What we have to do is to find some way of mediating the exchange process so that needs can be met when and where it's possible. So that's why money was invented, basically, is to provide this exchange medium, or this placeholder, by which people could provide what they needed to others and get what they needed later on from someone else. So initially we used commodities. And there have been many different commodities that have been used as exchange media, including things like tobacco in the American colonies. Gold, silver typically become the favored commodities to exchange, because they have certain properties that make them desirable as an exchange medium. But it's still a barter transaction. If I give you a piece of gold in return for your goods or services, we're basically doing a barter transaction, because gold and silver have value in themselves.
Right.
Later on, as banking developed, with the early bankers being the goldsmiths, who took deposits of gold and silver for safekeeping, they would then give you a receipt, basically a warehouse receipt or a claim check, for the gold or silver that you had on deposit. And then you could, at some later time, go back and claim your gold or your silver by submitting that that receipt. But then we found that in order to make it easy to transact business, people simply used the claim checks or the paper receipts as exchange media instead of the actual gold or silver, which remained on deposit with the goldsmith or the banker. So that was sort of a half step in using a symbolic exchange medium. The banknotes at that point were redeemable for gold and silver, so they were simply a virtual representation, if you will, of the value inherent in the gold and silver on deposit. But then later, bankers realized that not many people were coming to claim their gold, so they began to consider the possibility of issuing banknotes on the basis of some other collateral. Let's say a mortgage note on your farm. So you would go to the bank and say, I need to borrow some money in order to start a business, and the bank would check your credit and your ability to produce, and they might say, okay, we'll give you the loan. But they won't give you the loan in gold. They would give you the loan in banknotes, which they basically created.
Now, this is a really important step, I think, that it's important to people to understand. I love the story you have in your book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. You talk about how the goldsmith who was making the paper and taking the gold thought of the idea of loaning it, but then also giving the paper. That was a huge split in the way we use money, wasn't it? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, this was a major leap forward, and it change in the nature of money itself, because now money was no longer the value inherent in gold and silver. It was the value inherent in other assets that were pledged as collateral against the loan. But when you think about it, the banker really doesn't lend anything because he creates the money on the spot. In my book and in many of my slideshows, I show the process where the banker takes in a mortgage note as an asset and they create a deposit as a liability. So with two book entries, the bank is able to create money. And I call this credit money, also often called debt money, because bankers charge interest on this, even though they haven't given up anything. They simply monetize the value inherent in the collateral that you're putting up against the loan. So this was a very important step forward, because it made possible a lot of transactions that weren't possible before. The supplies of gold and silver are always limited, and it's very difficult to add to those supplies because you have to dig the ore out of the ground, you have to refine it, and creating new exchange media becomes very difficult.
You need ships and armadas, huh?
Exactly. And when the New World was discovered and the Spanish sent the conquistadors over to the New World, basically what they were looking for was gold.
Yeah.
And silver. And they plundered the mines in the Americas and South America and Central America and North America as well. And took the artifacts that the indigenous peoples had and melted them down, and they sent all of this back to Europe. And it provided a huge increase in the supply of money, which enabled a tremendous leap forward in commerce. But then when bankers discovered that they could create money as credit based on other collateral assets, then this really opened up the possibility for trade and industry. A lot of people want to go back to using gold and silver because of the abuses that have been done with credit money. But credit money is not a bad thing in itself. It's simply the way that credit money is created and allocated today by a banking cartel that causes the problems.
Let's talk about how it's being used to centralize power, concentrate wealth, and undermine popular governments.
Right. That's a primary thesis of my book, The End of Money. Money has been politicized. There was a bargain made between the banking interests and the political interests way back more than 300 years ago. And I point to the Bank of England as the archetype. It was the first, well, maybe not the first central bank, but as the archetype central bank that was copied in every country around the world virtually. So the Bank of England was created in 1694 when William Paterson went to the King of England with a proposition. At that time, the King was William III, and he was fighting a war against France and finding it difficult to finance the war. Wars are very expensive propositions, and of course, anyone who wages war has to pay the troops, has to pay the people that supply the weapons and the clothing and the other things that are needed by the armed forces. So William Paterson and some of his cohorts came to the king with a proposition that they would provide the king with the money he needed to fight the war if the king would give the Bank of England the privilege of creating money in the form of banknotes and lending it into circulation. So out of this came basically a monopoly on the issuance of banknotes and a domination by the Bank of England of all of the other banks throughout the country. And that system has been replicated in the central banks of virtually every country around the world.
When you're saying this, you're talking about political money and money being politicized. Can you include that in this description too?
Yeah, well, the deal was that the banks were given the privilege of creating money and lending
political isolation,
and charging interest on it. Mm-hmm. And in return, the king was given privileged access to that new form of credit money. And we see that happening today in the United States. that's been happening over the whole history of the United States when the central bank model was replicated at the very founding of the United States of America. Alexander Hamilton and some of his financier cohorts proposed that a Bank of the United States be established here that would be modeled after the Bank of England. So the first Bank of the United States was a central bank on the Bank of England model that was chartered in 1791. And when that charter expired in 1811, we had a short period of time with no central bank. But then in 1816, the second Bank of the United States was chartered, again, for a period of 20 years, and it was given similar privileges to what the Bank of England enjoyed in Britain.
Now, that was controversial. I mean, didn't Jefferson and many other people really fight that and try to stop it?
Yes, of course. Jefferson was against it, and there were a lot of people that were against the privilege being given to the central bank. Mm-hmm. And this became a major issue in the campaign in 1832 when Andrew Jackson was running for re-election. He was adamant against a central bank and a privileged banking monopoly, and it was a campaign issue. Nicholas Biddle, who was the president at that time of the second bank, tried to get his bank rechartered early. He didn't want to wait till 1836. He thought he had the votes he needed in 1832 to get the Bank Charter Act passed through Congress. And in fact, he did get it through Congress. Congress passed the bill to recharter the bank, but then Jackson vetoed it. So Jackson single-handedly ended the banking monopoly and the central bank in the United States. Hmm. So we went through a period of time up to the Civil War where banking was relatively free in the United States. Some economists pejoratively refer to that period as the wildcat banking era. And it's true there were some abuses of the credit creation privilege, but by and large, the abundance of credit enabled tremendous advances in industry and production within the United States. And even Alan Greenspan, in one of his speeches that I've posted on my blog, refers to that free banking era with a positive opinion.
You've said that in your book, today's centralized global money system is the root cause of pretty much the mega crisis that's confronting civilization. So how is our current money system driving the environmental, social justice, spiritual malaise, all of these this mega crisis that's coming to us? And well, just let's answer that. How is that driving it?
Well, this is a key question. When you consider how money is created today, that banks create it on the basis of loans that they charge interest on, you have everything in the economy being driven by the compound interest formula, which is an exponential growth formula. So when you consider, let's say you go to a bank and you borrow $100,000, and you, instead of making monthly payments, you pay it back all at once at the end of some period of time. Just with the passage of time, the amount that you owe is going to grow according to compound interest. So if the interest rate is 10%, in a year's time you're going to owe $110,000 on your original $100,000 loan. And at the end of 2 years, you're going to owe $121,000 and some change, and so on.
Because the interest is applied to the total.
Right, because the interest accumulates, and then you pay interest on the interest.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a growth phenomenon. We have inherent in our monetary system today this debt imperative, which I just described, which leads to a growth imperative. Conventional economists are always talking about economic growth, that we have to grow our way out of our recession, that economic growth is the only option for prosperity.
That's a really problematic. I've always wondered, how can you have continuous growth with finite resources at the just bottom line sense of it?
Exactly, and I refer to the limits of growth study that was done back in the 1970s that was commissioned by the Club of Rome. Basically, that argues that on a finite planet, you cannot have infinite growth. And with this growth imperative that's built into the monetary system, we have companies continually trying to find new markets, exploiting additional resources, despoliating the environment in an attempt to produce more, to sell more, to avoid defaulting on their debt. So everybody's in that boat. We have increasing debts in all sectors of the economy and inability for those debts to be carried. Now, we've seen within the last few years how we've reached the break point in that exponential growth curve. And if you look at total debt just in the United States, in all sectors, you see how it's shooting skyward.
Is it $14 trillion or something?
Well, that's just the U.S. government.
I see.
Yeah. It's close to, I think it's $13 trillion at this point. And it's grown about 35% just in the last 3 years. Okay. So the government is projecting deficits that are just unheard of.
It's grown 35% in 3 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
$1.5 trillion deficits for the foreseeable future. And so, you know, this is an untenable situation. There's no way that the economy can sustain that kind of a debt load.
Will that ever be paid?
No.
You couldn't pay the interest on it.
Well, the interest is eating up an increasing portion of our government budget.
Mm-hmm.
This is an unsustainable situation.
And how much of that is attributable to war and weapons and the security, supposedly, and the war on terrorism and all of that?
It's a huge percentage. If you look at the U.S. government budget, you'll see that a huge percentage of it goes to supporting the military and supporting the imperial process around the world. A lot of times the politicians will point to entitlements like Social Security and Medicare, and it's true there's a lot of waste in those programs, but you know they're going to want to cut those programs before they're going to give up their imperial ambitions.
Right.
So it's going to be a really interesting next few years when we see how all this is going to play out. We're seeing limits to debt growth being played out in Europe right now. Greece is prominent in the news because their debt load, the government debt load, is much greater than their GDP. And so they're part of the euro community using the euro currency instead of their own drachma currency, which they gave up several years ago. So in order to remain as part of the Eurozone, they're being forced to curtail social spending. So that means government employees are going to be paid less, pensions are going to be cut, all kinds of things that are going to be very painful for the people of Greece in order for the government to pay what is owed to its creditors.
And, of course, there's huge public outcry and resistance to
these changes.
Yeah, of course.
We're seeing tremendous social upheaval.
Which is probably a pretty good model for what, you know, what we might expect here.
Exactly. And Peter Schiff spoke on that recently, and I posted a video of him on my blog, beyondmoney.net, where he points to the fact that the U.S. is in a worse situation with regard to government debt, and we're facing the same prospect.
Yeah. This, you know, you say in your book that you think money is going to become obsolete. That could take a lot of roads, which we ought to talk about. But why do you think money is going to become obsolete?
Because it already is.
All right.
I started talking about the evolution of exchange media.
Right.
And we got as far as credit money. The ultimate step in the evolution of reciprocal exchange is what is called credit clearing. And when you think about it, that's really what banks do today, is they simply clear debits and credits. Let's suppose you're employed by a company that pays you directly by depositing your paycheck to your account, your bank account. This is a direct allocation of a number to an account. It's simply transferring a number. So your account is being credited for your salary. Your balance goes up. Then you take your checkbook or your debit card and you go shopping and you buy things that you need and want. Those things are debited. They are taken off of your account.
Right.
So it's really just a process of debits and credits going through an account. There is no money.
But you're starting, you know, from this premise, you're starting from the idea that there's credit put in there. You're not borrowing money at this point.
Well, somebody has borrowed it.
Right.
The question is, where did your employer get the money to pay you?
I mean, a debit card, you have to have something there.
Right.
A credit card, you've got to get that money from somewhere, borrow that money currently at a usurious interest rate.
That's right. That's right. If you have a credit card and you carry a balance on your account, that's basically a loan that the bank has made to you on your signature. And you're paying, as you point out, usurious rates of interest on that.
It can be all the way up to, I think, 30%. Is that?
Sometimes even more.
Oh,
and
God.
If you're late with a payment, they'll sock you with a late payment fee.
I thought that was illegal. Whatever happened to the laws around usury?
Oh, those laws have gone away a long time ago. There used to be usury laws in every state,
right,
which limited the amount of interest that lenders could charge.
Hmm.
But, you know, the banking interests have always gotten their way on legislation. Most recently, we've seen the elimination of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial banking from investment banking and speculation. And that's one of the reasons why we got into this huge mess that came to a head in the fall of 2008 when the government had to bail out the financial sector. And the only way the government can bail out the financial sector is by assuming their bad debts. The government doesn't have any money either. The money gets created by the banking system.
Say a little more about the relationship of the central bank and the government and this lending system. I think that's kind of challenging to follow exactly. It's supposed to be an independent organization, but it doesn't seem to run that way.
Well, the question is, independent of what?
not of political influence.
Right. It's the same people who run both the banking sector and the government.
Mm-hmm.
If we think that we're electing people to serve our interests, we're sadly mistaken. And I think most people are coming to realize that the whole Congress, virtually, with maybe a few exceptions, is bought and paid for by the special interests, primarily the financial interests.
Let's take a middle place here and talk about the whole inflation process and what can be expected in terms of our own current monetary system in the next few years, really.
Well, inflation is simply the creation of money on an improper basis. If money is created on the basis of goods and services that are in the market already or shortly to arrive on the market, then you have proper basis for creation of money, because money is really a placeholder. It's a virtual representation of things that are in the market ready to be bought. And it's the creation of this money by giving producers credit that enables them to sell their product. But banks have strayed far from the sound principles of commercial banking, and they create money on the basis of a lot of things that don't put anything of value into the market. Typically, government bonds. When a bank buys a U.S. government bond, it is basically lending to the government, but the government isn't putting any goods or services into the economy on the basis of that money. So what you have is a dilution effect. All of the money that's already in circulation is losing its purchasing power, because it's as if a counterfeiter were flooding the market with counterfeit money. The counterfeiter has no intention of reciprocating. The counterfeiter simply wants to take real value out of the economy, but has no intention of putting real value back into the economy. Now, an issuer of money, really, if it's an honest issuer, is obligated to redeem his own issuance of money by providing real goods and services as payment for it. So what you have is this tremendous government debt being monetized by the banking system. So it's putting empty dollars into the economy, and these dollars are competing with the other dollars for whatever is available in the market to be bought. Now, the reason we're not seeing galloping inflation just yet is because the productive sector has been made to pay the cost of this profligate government spending and the abuses by the banking sector. So the small businesses particularly are being starved for credit. So they're going bankrupt and employees are being thrown out of work. So we have the productive sector being starved for credit and people scrounging for a few dollars to put food on the table and pay the rent, while at the same time, military-industrial financial complex is being lavished with credit, and you have that sector doing very well. So the question is, when is the inflation going to kick in?
Right.
And it's going to take some major adjustments on the part of the people that are being starved for credit before that happens. It's already happening.
Yeah, I was going to say it is happening. I liked your analogy in the book, and if you just tuned in, I'm talking to Thomas Greco, author of The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. I like your very simple analogy of the farmer milking the cow and then beginning to add water to the milk but charging the same price.
Right.
It's really happening in all areas. So this inflation is already there. But when would you call it hyperinflation, which, of course, is pretty much, once it hits there, I think it's unstoppable, isn't it?
Well, hyperinflation, I make the point in my book that inflation is the improper creation of money. Mm-hmm. And rising prices of real goods and services are the result of inflation as a currency. So we're seeing rising prices in some sectors, particularly food and energy, and we're going to see it across the board eventually. And those rising prices are the result of this improper issuance of money, which is taking on huge proportions. If we look back at history, we can see examples of hyperinflations in the past. And we don't have to look very far. We can see one in Zimbabwe right now. The Zimbabwean government has been creating money willy-nilly and spending it into the economy and causing tremendous increases in the prices of everything in the market. And, of course, when governments try to force people to accept a debased currency, you end up with empty store shelves because the people that have something of real value don't want to accept debased currency in exchange for it, because that currency is losing value minute by minute.
I heard that one of the new currencies in Zimbabwe that's being used is phone cards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting way to avoid inflation.
Right. In an inflationary situation, you want to hold something that isn't denominated in the units of the national currency.
Yeah.
So that could be phone minutes, or it could be commodities of some sort, or it could be anything that you think is going to hold its value relative to the currency.
What's the impact, Tom, of peak oil, which is hard to believe when you look at the prices here, but of course that relates then to government subsidies. You know, we are at peak oil by all professional opinions. What's your thoughts about the impact on the money system, since everything that we do and own seems to be somehow related to oil?
Yeah, that's a good point. Going back to the limits to growth, peak oil is just one aspect of that. We're seeing that the easily available oil has already been exploited, and now we're having to go deeper and deeper into the oceans to try to find additional oil. And we're seeing the result of that in the Gulf right now with this huge disaster of the oil spill, which is going to have far-reaching consequences for the fishing industry, the tourism on the Gulf Coast, and all kinds of other things that provide livelihood for the people in that region. So the costs aren't being totally reckoned by the oil companies. They're allowed to avoid much of the cost of their activity.
Well, that brings up two important issues. One is subsidies, and the other is the externalized debt that's happening in so many different industries. What impact is that having, and how is that going to change the future?
Well, we're seeing not only the peak oil, but we're also seeing climate change as a result of greenhouse gas emissions. We're seeing resource depletion across the board, not only in petroleum, but in other of the resources that we depend on in our industrial society. So I think what we're headed for is a steady state economy. We're not going to be able to continue to live the way we have in the first world.
What do you mean by steady state economy?
A no-growth economy.
No growth, okay.
It doesn't mean that some sectors won't grow. It means that there will be overall a steady state that will be producing as much as we need and no more. And the range of goods and services that we're producing will shift as well, more toward necessities and away from the things that are wasteful. You know, over my lifetime, I've seen a tremendous shift from durable goods to disposable goods. Everything is throwaway now, and that uses tremendous amounts of resources. We've made tremendous gains in labor productivity, that is, we get more out of each unit of labor. At the same time, we've been wasting materials. So material productivity is going to have to increase rather than labor productivity. We have to get more value out of each ounce or pound of material. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I think, pretty easy to do that. When you tally up all the things that we're doing that are so wasteful, just cleaning up the oil spill, for example.
That's more than wasteful from what's happening with some of the toxic materials that are in the very thing they're using to clean it up.
Yeah. Exactly.
Again, more externalized costs in the terms of health and damage to the ecosystem.
Right, and that's a problem with corporations generally across the board. You know, they pocket the profits and socialize the costs to a large extent.
Right.
So we're moving toward a sustainable, convivial new world order, as I call it. You can contrast that with today's world order, which is characterized by scarcity and a belief in the sinful human nature. It's characterized by violent conflict, command and control methods of imposing order, and rule by a small elite. And the new world order that the politicians have been talking about for several decades now is nothing more than a further advance in that old world order.
Right. With free trade and centralized control over the world, basically.
Right. Yeah. Right. So it's a continual process that we've seen of concentration of wealth in fewer hands, and centralization of power in the hands of a small elite group. Well, that runs totally contrary to American ideals of democratic government, government of the people, by the people, and for the people. But what I see is a major shift, not only economically, but also politically and socially. The new world order, as I envision it, which is going to be a convivial new world order, will be based on a belief in abundance and sufficiency, a belief in the collective intelligence, the ability of the community to govern itself, and a potential for human improvement, that human nature is not a fixed thing. It's our behavior is determined largely by the situation that we find ourselves in and the systems in which we are embedded. And I refer in my book to the work of Philip Zimbardo at Stanford University with the Stanford Prison Experiment. He showed very clearly how people's behavior is determined by the situation in which they are embedded. We need to create a new world order that is more just and equitable, based on nonviolent conflict resolution, distributive justice, and the potential for human improvement.
So how do we create an exchange system with those values at the center that doesn't force perpetual economic growth?
Well, the prescriptions that I outline in my book are mainly for changes to happen at the business level, at the community level, through nonprofit organizations and for-profit businesses, basically doing their own credit clearing process. So I talk about mutual credit clearing associations, which will basically make banking and conventional money obsolete and unnecessary. Because as I pointed out before, money is nothing more than an information system. And it's just a matter of keeping a record of debits and credits. If you consider a common practice of businesses giving each other credit, you might be a toy store. You sell toys at the retail level. Let's suppose I'm a toy manufacturer and I'm one of your suppliers. Typically, what I might do is you'll send me an order for $100,000 worth of toys. I will ship the toys along with an invoice, and the invoice will give you maybe 30 days or 60 days or even longer to pay what you owe for the shipment. Time gives you the time to sell those toys at retail and to accumulate the resources in order to pay what you owe me. Businesses typically give each other credit in this way. It's called doing business on open account. And so what we're doing here with a mutual credit clearing system is simply generalizing that credit involving a number of different businesses so that each can be paid throughout the supply chain. So the credit is being allocated to you not only by me, but all the other members of the association.
So here we are in a little town up here in Nevada City, California, and we're tied into the big economic machine of the country, the dollar machine. Let's say that we want to create an alternative system here. I mean, this isn't going to just fall out of the sky completely done. We have to start somewhere. So how do you start a system like this and then grow that system inside of the traditional system?
It's very simple to start a system, but to make it viable requires a certain scale and a certain amount of variety of goods and services within the exchange.
Right.
We started Tucson Traders here in Tucson many years ago with a notebook and a pen. And each member had a page in the notebook, which was basically their account record, and you had several columns on the page to record the different transactions of each member. So when I buy something, my account is debited, and when I sell something, my account is credited, and you keep a running balance on each page. Very shortly, we had enough people in the system that we wanted to computerize the records. So we had a spreadsheet or a computer program that would make it easier to maintain those accounts. And there are many accounting programs that have been developed over the years for keeping track of these kinds of exchanges.
But most of these systems that have been set up haven't lasted too long, and like you said, it's probably because of the number of people and the variety of the goods and services that are being offered through them.
Right. There are a number of reasons why they haven't thrived, and one of the main reasons is the lack of scale and the lack of involvement by the business community. There are commercial trade exchanges that offer this clearing service to mostly retail businesses, and they're in virtually every city around the country and around the world. There are commercial trade exchanges like IMS, BarterCard, iTex, TradeSource.
Now, many of those are coupled, though, to the current dollar rate. And for the kind of system it seems to be valuable to avoid getting taken down with the dollar system would be to have something that could decouple from that. But then you have the issue of valuation. How, if you didn't have a dollar basis, how do you value something?
Okay, there are two issues here. We have to decouple from the dollar as, first of all, an exchange medium, and secondly, as a measure of value. By creating our own credit within our own mutual credit clearing system, we become independent of the banking system to give us dollars. In Tucson Traders, we called our unit Tucson Tokens, and everybody was allocated a certain number of tokens on the basis of their ability to provide value to the system. So that's basically the credit creation process. We create our own credit for our own use within our own community. But Tucson Token, in terms of its value measure, was equivalent in value to a U.S. dollar. So we became independent of the dollar to some degree, one account, that is by creating our own credit, but we maintained our tie to the dollar in terms of value measurement. So people are accustomed to thinking of terms of dollars in this country because we're all shopping every day and we know what things cost in dollar terms, even though those prices are going up continually, and occasionally prices go down on some things, like computers and electronics. That's a second stage development that we have to look at. Eventually, we're going to have to value our accounts in something other than U.S. dollars, because as the dollar becomes increasingly debased and devalued, then we'll want to have a unit of account that's going to hold up. Time being, for an exchange system, we can let that one slide for a little bit.
It's a challenging one. I remember back when I was a young environmental student, a guy named Howard Odum, who wrote Energy Basis for Man and Nature.
Mm-hmm.
I often thought, you know, although that's fairly complex, in some ways it's simple, but in many ways it's complex, that that would be a good exchange value. But just trying to start something, you know, on a local level here, to give you an idea of the, you know, challenge from my perspective, I teach a moving meditation. People pay $15 to come in to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody wants to, you know, and there's 30, 50, 60 people, whatever. There's a lot of preparation in doing that and putting something together every time. Somebody else says, I'd like to come there, but I do massage. I'm in the service industry. Would you trade that? So I look at the dollar basis. I charge $15, and they charge $90. That would, mm-hmm. you know, that would mean however many dances that comes out. It's what, five, six dances, something like that. But at any rate, there's this value where someone spends an hour to do this, but doesn't have any preparation time other than the earlier learning of that skill.
Yes.
Just using that as one example of the complexity of valuation, to me, seems like the most important issue in this.
Yeah, well, you highlight a point that has been discussed over and over again. Many well-intentioned people have tried to create exchange systems in which an hour of one kind is exchanged for an hour of another. That's obviously not going to work very well, because how do you measure what goes into an hour's work?
Right.
An hour of brain surgery is certainly going to take a lot more resources than an hour of babysitting.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't expect people to exchange simply time. There's a whole lot more that goes into providing a service than just the time spent doing it. They tried to do this in Ithaca with the Ithaca Hour Currency. This was started back in 1991, I think it was. It's 19 years down the road. They call their unit an hour, and their notes are denominated in hours. But the question people had right off the bat was, well, what is an hour worth? And they wanted to know in terms of dollars what an hour was worth. So they just sort of arbitrarily said, well, maybe the average wage is about $10. Let's say that an hour an Ithaca hour is worth about $10. Well, here we are almost 20 years later. The dollar has been tremendously inflated and the purchasing power has declined. But, you know, an Ithaca hour is still said to be equivalent to $10. Where in reality, if it was an independent unit of account, it would have a much greater value in dollar terms today than it did back then.
Exactly. A lot of people, including myself, feel that this system doesn't have much longer to last, given all the different things that are happening, particularly the impact on the environment, the separation, the growing concentration of wealth in a very few, and the increasing poverty around the world, you know, the impact on resources, all these different things. This system is basically doomed from my perspective, and I think other people's perspective. But I'm trying to find a model in one of these that, you know, commercial trade exchange and that, but everything, you know, it's really hard to find a model that we can start and work with. So,
well, I'll give you one. As far as the exchange process is concerned, you know, I pointed to the commercial trade exchanges, but also there's a mutual credit clearing exchange that has been successful over a period of 75 years in Switzerland.
Yeah.
It's called the VIR, W-I-R. And it was started in 1934 by small and medium-sized business owners who wanted to continue to do business with one another, even though there wasn't enough official money in circulation. So they came up with this credit clearing process in which they basically give each other credit as a way of mediating their exchanges. At last count, this system had 60,000 business members throughout Switzerland, and they're clearing about $2 billion worth of transactions every year. Now, the VIR has gone through a lot of changes. It has become a conventional bank in the mid-90s, but it's still doing the direct credit clearing process in addition to conventional banking services. Now, that's a model that could be emulated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing more about that particular
you can
system.
You can find more documentation on that on my blog, beyondmoney.net.
Okay. beyondmoney.net. And the name of Thomas's book, Thomas Greco Jr., The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. We've just got a little bit of time left, Thomas, but I always like to look and see what can the little individual do to bring about change in this big system. You know, how can we personally start to shift the way we use our money to bring back a more fair and equitable system?
Well, that's of course the most important question. What can we do? We have to look at not only what we can do individually, but what we have to do collectively. We have to learn to share, we have to learn to cooperate, and we have to reorganize ourselves in ways that we haven't done before. Looking at existing resources, you need to allocate those resources in ways that support what I call the butterfly economy. You know, I think we're going through a metamorphic process throughout the world today, from what we might consider to be the caterpillar economy, which has been very destructive to the environment. It's accumulated a lot of resources, but we've reached limits to growth. And when a caterpillar reaches those limits, it stops growing, and it goes into another phase where the caterpillar body breaks down, and the imaginal cells that were in the caterpillar's body begin to become active and join up together to form the new butterfly creature. So I think we're going through that kind of process, and I tell people when they ask me this question, what can I do in order to support the transition to a sustainable economy, I say feed the butterfly, not the caterpillar. Invest in the butterfly, not the caterpillar. So take the resources you have and invest them in things that are going to support life into the future, things that are going to regenerate the environment, things that will provide the basis for life and help you to thrive in the future. Things like renewable energy, things like local food production, things like energy-efficient houses. All of those things can support you and help you to survive the transition. But it's not only that. We also have to organize ourselves in ways to create new structures like the mutual credit clearing structures, the local currencies, that are going to be necessary in order for us to transact business with one another and to provide each other with the things that we need.
Well, Thomas, I so much appreciate your time and your wisdom and the many years that you've spent looking at this issue. It's really inspiring, and it's an emerging process. I think it does come back to, you know, what the individual can do, get informed and act appropriate. So thank you so much for being on Conversations.
Well, you're most welcome. It's been a pleasure, Michael.
Thomas Greco, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, here on Conversations on KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City and 105.1 FM in Truckee. So that's it for today. I have some great shows coming up. Remember, you can always go to arewelistening.net or just Google Conversations with Michael Stone and listen to past shows. We put them up and edit them so you can listen. You can also get on the newsletter so you can get the latest shows coming out every month in the newsletter on a monthly basis. Coming up next week, Melanie Lanehart, Dr. Melanie Lanehart. She is an ecologist, talks about life in the hothouse, how a living planet survives climate change, and how we can too. The following week, Buddhist author, teacher, and lecturer Kevin Griffith, One Breath at a Time. And coming up next month, Jeremy Rifkin. So stay tuned, and also stay tuned. Up next, Tom Myers, So Many Roads. Music Magazine, Elisa Parker, KVMR News tonight at 6, 7 p.m., Democracy Now! And The Other Side at 8 with Rick O'Shea, 10 o'clock Transit Lounge with Bill Emerson. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned for Tom Myers, So Many Roads.